Thanks. Thank you for having me here. Thank Jim for the introduction, my deconstruction guy. Have you heard the quote, "Why build these cities beautiful if man unbuilded goes?" Anybody familiar with those words?
Say them again.
Why build these cities beautiful if man unbuilded goes? In vain we build the world unless the builder also grows. And that kind of ties together from Kennedy's favorite poet, Edwin Markham. He used to use that poem around his place a lot, and it always stuck with me. And it's kind of what I thought the Peace Corps was. Why build these cities beautiful if man unbuilded goes? In vain you build the world unless the builder also grows. And when you do the Peace Corps, you're trying to build cities or villages or whatever you're working in, but you're also trying to grow as a human being and understand how the world works. And when Jim talks about the race between the 1% or the rich or the vile among the 1% who want to run things, it's kind of that race that's going on. When I look at movies like The Gladiator, and you go back in time, you say, what happened to the Roman Empire, and why did the gladiators consume so much of the masses' time? Because they wanted to entertain the masses. And we have that with football today. I mean, you guys don't do it as well as the 49ers do. And we're cleaner than most teams, and they have rules. So we've progressed from lions eating gladiators to football with rules and trying not to spearhead somebody. And that's the kind of race, I think, that's going on. Do you fund these stadiums with taxpayers' dollars? And do you entertain the masses and dumb them down as Fox News would like to do? Or do you get them out in the world? And the World Service Corps proposal, I'm going to tell you what it is, as Jim likes to keep saying, tell them what it is early in case they don't get it. But I'm going to tell you what, why, how, and when, and then I'm going to try and wrap a few stories. And when 15 minutes has gone by, would somebody tell me, because Derek wants me to do it in about 20, so if you give me a five-minute thing, I'll know to wrap something up. What it is, in brief, it would ramp up over 7 years by about 150-some-thousand a year. Additional Americans would join this national voluntary service program, but they'd have their choice. They could choose to serve Peace Corps, AmeriCorps, Habitat, Doctors Without Borders, Head Start, Red Cross, International Rescue, Oxfam, Mercy Corps, State Conservation Corps, all these groups that you hear of that do good things and expose young, middle-aged people or whatever age people to doing something in the world, so they come back from that doing and really know a hell of a lot more than most of the broadcasters on television tell you. And that's the race. Are we going to educate enough Americans who once were the most powerful nation in the world, and I think we're slipping dramatically, but now give those experiences. So it ramps up by that amount each year for 7 years. So by the seventh year, seven times that amount, you have a million additional Americans voluntarily serving in those organizations, or an organization, say, in Southeast San Diego that might do something for midnight basketball, or an organization that tries to build community and get rid of the gangs or something that may be developing. Or they might decide to be teacher's assistants in schools. Now, they're going to do this full-time. They're not going to get paid a lot of money. They're going to get paid what basically a Peace Corps volunteer gets, live in the community as a Peace Corps volunteer does, but they're doing it at home if they want to in America, which would be AmeriCorps, which is the Peace Corps equivalent of Peace Corps. And or it might be with the Seventh Church of Christ, as long as they're not proselytizing, but they're working on feeding poor people in the slums. They might work at Glide Memorial in San Francisco, where Glide feeds like 2 million people a year, homeless people, right in the Tenderloin. So you have these Americans working, and the legislation says once you hit a million, you continue doing that for 20 years before you consider sunsetting the legislation. Sunsetting means, you know, you look at it again and say, it's done, it's good, let's drop it. So over the course of 27 years, 7 years to build it, 20 years to do it, then after 27 years, you'd have about 21 million Americans that would have served at home or abroad. And they would be a hell of a lot smarter and a hell of a lot more aware of what's going on in the world. And they wouldn't be hoodwinked by campaign slogans. And what I tell some politicians that are willing to listen is, I don't think it's so important to run for dog catcher, planning commissioner, scenic arts commission, city council. I don't know if that's as relevant today as it is doing service for the needy at home and abroad and taking that experience into politics. I tend to find most politicians who have run for political office all their life are kind of shallow. They don't get what's going on in the world, and they got all these mundane things that they're trying to deal with. So that's part of the what behind what it would do. The why I've already hinted at, and one of the big kickbacks from doing the Peace Corps, which Peace Corps volunteers will tell you and the Peace Corps tells you itself, is you may not get a lot done while you're doing your 2 years of service. You're probably going to learn more than you've given, and most Peace Corps volunteers will tell you that. Their service has given them more than they feel they were able to give to the community they worked in. So this then raises the public policy IQ, which when you're the nation with the biggest guns and the biggest missiles and the most drones, you better start having a better public policy, because you're still going to fall just the way the Romans did. You can't hide from people who hate you but don't show you in their face. I played basketball for years up at the YMCA. There are four Iranian guys that come in all the time. They didn't like to switch teams. Now, two of them were rather nice guys. The biggest guy, the toughest guy, the most athletic guy. You could bump up and play hard and it was okay. But there was two guys that were always sullen. Now, they played together all the time. The story was they had their own plane. They flew back and forth from Iran. And you could tell they didn't like Americans. There had been a couple fights started. And one day, this guy gave me a shot to the eye. You know, maybe Jim's trained at this, but to shoot somebody in the eye with your finger straight open, when you're not shooting, you're not doing anything, just stunned me. And if you're trained to do that, it doesn't mean anything. It didn't dawn on me that this guy did it. You know, somebody does something, somebody would have punched me, I would have gone at him. But I was just so stunned, and it took some sight out of this eye. But that's what you're dealing with if you're making enemies. You can't tell. Most of the time, this guy, Mike Mashoud was his name, you know, he left the Y right after that. Now, when I go in my conspiracy mode, I kind of go, well, how do you know who really hates Americans and who's here for a long time so that they know how to do things and maybe they can blow something up? And how do you test them to see if they're really willing to do something that's stealthy and dangerous? I think that's existing a lot in this country. Though we have drones and technology and kids that are better at playing computers than anybody, that's still not going to win the war for you. Your country's going down, especially when you go to these countries and you say, why is the French and the American Rangers going after the Malians? Well, what we get in the news is that they're radicals. What you get if you're over there is that they're tired of seeing the oil dumped in the rivers that they live alongside. Not many Americans know that, but if you had a bunch of volunteers serving in that part of the world and they're writing back to their folks and their friends and they're coming back and they're going to grad school because they did this stuff, they're talking about those things. And that's a better source of information, but we don't have that kind. If you saw some of the slideshow, we have 1.4 million active military. You add up the inactive, it's 3 point something million. They're getting experiences, and unfortunately, a lot of them are PTSD experiences and Gold Star moms who are torn apart, torn asunder by what they've learned about their country. But if we had an army that fielded heroes, and I think Peace Corps volunteers are just as much heroes, and more so in many cases if you've had to do dastardly things in the military, but we don't match them up. We don't have teams. Americans like to think they want to be on offense. So this is a way to put Americans on offense. Build an army. Charlie Rangel has tried to reinstitute the draft. I don't have any problem with the draft. You know, as Jim was suggesting, people serve together. Suddenly you realize that blacks and people from the South aren't so bad, and the dumbs from the South hang around with the blacks, and they... After a guy saved his life once or twice, he says, I'm a little less prejudiced. So those kind of things are good. But he's never been able to get the draft going again to get all Americans to serve. But, so this is a halfway thing, and the reason I have all these organizations listed in there is because Republicans like to say, we like to give Americans choice. So you give them a list of choices. You know, say, okay, you know, you choose which one of those good organizations, and you can add smaller organizations. I want to stress, a lot of smaller organizations could use 10 more volunteers a year and get a ton more done. Habitat, when I talk to people high up, and I do Habitats quite often, Habitat for Humanity, where you build homes. But I talked to a guy somewhat up there in the chain of command, and I said, would this, what I'm trying to do, work? And he says, yeah, but it would work for us in a much better way, unlike how you probably think it would work. We don't need a lot more new builders. We don't need those people to come and build homes for us as much as we need mid-aged people who would come in our office and help us get this stuff out the door, because we're overburdened. We can't organize and do the stuff that mid-aged and baby boomers can do. They may not be able to work 10 hours in a day out in the sun in Ethiopia, but they sure as hell know how to organize things and get more of that going. So that's one of the benefits there. And it flips off, you know, in another, have any of you read Confessions of an Economic Hitman? Okay, well, Derek knows what it's about. And Perkins is a former Peace Corps volunteer who ends up being an energy analyst, makes a whole bunch of money for Maine Consulting Company, because he's bringing in oil companies, he's bringing in big American builders, Bechtel, and he's forcing these countries to go deep in the debt. And you probably know how many banks are in the Federal Reserve that run the Federal Reserve. I bet you Derek knows that. Who else?
Well.
Yeah. So, you know, you got these banks that are making the interest on our debt. Well, he starts figuring all that out, and he's rubbed by his Peace Corps service, where he was doing, quote, good, but he really likes women, and they know that's a weakness, and they, you know, ply him with women when they need to, and they ply him with money. And when you read Confessions of an Economic Hitman, you see how we're screwing these countries left and right, putting them into debt, and building the stuff that we bomb or we destroy with American companies. So there's this huge loop that the money keeps coming back in. Those kind of things are what this gets at dealing with. And it gets us away from I was going to tell another story. I had a friend in college, which, have any of you read the most recent book, Kill Anything That Moves?
Yeah.
Well, it's just out. And I had a friend in college. Sophomore year football, this guy had transferred from the top small college in the country. And we're in a U-shaped shower. I told Jim the story. You know, tiles, four-pointed knobs. And as freshmen, we had beaten the varsity. And the varsity was filled with thugs, Chicago mafia types. Schreiber, 6'6", 285. Gugliotta, 6'2", 250. Ozdowski, you know.
He's an Irish guy.
No, he wasn't. Well, he punched. You know, he punched because he punched through your mask because he couldn't get through to you. So we beat these guys, 4 touchdowns to 2, and they were gunning for a number of us. And so I'm in the shower taking a shower. I don't like these guys. They don't like me. And I hear, "Come on, you mother effer!" And I heard "mother effer" a lot of times. "You want to get it on? Let's get it on." And I go, "What?" You know. And there's a wall here for me. So I walk around the wall and I look down there. There are those three guys I just mentioned, and this new guy standing there. Says, "Come on, let's do it. Let's do it. Let's see what you got." And I'm saying, "The last place you want to fight is in a place like this. You know, you're slipping and sliding." And this guy is there, and so, you know, they just freeze. And he said, "Well, anytime you want a piece of me, come and get me." Later, we're getting dressed. They're in the locker room. It's almost empty. He's on the other side of the locker room. I walk over there. I put my hand out. I say, "Hi, my name is Dwayne Hunt." And he just looks at it. And I go, "My God, the guy's not even going to shake hands." And he looks at me, and after 30 seconds, he says, "My name's Dick Behringer. My friends call me the Bear." From that point on, I was protected. You know, my backside was okay. If the Bear was on my side, I knew everything was okay. They're not going to get me from behind. He goes into the Vietnam, And I stay in touch with him. I go to Saigon after Peace Corps. You know, it was easy. In my T-shirt, crew cut, I look like I belong there. So I roam around Saigon, and I go to the KP, and I say, hey, you guys ever hear of Dick Barnes? Oh, the bear. Yeah, the bear. He's on the boonies. I said, does he ever get in here? Oh, no, he never gets in here. No. So the years tumble by, and he gets out, and I pick up the phone one day when I see that it looks like he's back in Florida. And so I call him, and I say, hey, Dick, you know, we're carrying on a bit. And I said, you know, I came to Saigon. I came to Vietnam looking for you. He says, no. He says, you did? I says, yeah. I said, you know, I went into Saigon. He says, holy shit, you were in danger. I said, in danger? I said, I was rolled in the alley, I guess. But, you know, I said, no, you were in danger. You're in the jungle there. He says, F no. He said, anything that moved, we just blew up. Anything that moves, we just kill. And then 2 weeks ago on NPR, they interview this guy. The title of his book is Kill Anything That Moves. And it was the same words that Dick had used on me, and that's why it stuck in my head. And this guy went looking for information about the number of civilian casualties in Vietnam. And some guy said, well, would confidential files help you any? And the Congress, a Library of Congress guy gave him all this stuff. And he discovered that my lie was not a single incident. It was operating procedure. And it's that kind of stuff that we've done for so long that if we don't tell the world with a big PR campaign, look, we're starting to do the American World Service Corps, and we think you, China, ought to do the same thing. Jim added an apostrophe. I kept calling it the American World Service Corps, and he said, why don't you call it America's World Service Corps? Which I put in the legislation. If you ever get a chance, just go to the website, worldservicecorps.us, and it's only 12 or 15 pages, so it's simple legislation, but it does say at the end, this ought to prompt other nations to do the same thing. And if you switch the emphasis from competing with guns and missiles, and instead of doing that, you send nations on a mission rather than with missiles, so you start changing the whole context of the world. And if we don't start doing that, then with climate change raining down on us, along with all this hidden hatreds and stealth hatreds going on, then I think we're going to have some bigger problems. You got some questions? I still have a few more minutes, but if you got some questions, I'll...
I have a question. Wayne, the thing that I keep thinking about is, why don't we just quit doing the stuff that's making the world mad at us? And mostly it's about oil. You know, we've got 800 bases in 125 countries, and it's all about oil and maybe a few other natural resources. And it seems to me we ought to just quit doing the stuff we're doing and start letting the world know we're changing our ways. And we wouldn't need a bunch of volunteers overseas because they would see, because otherwise if we keep doing what we're doing but we're sending volunteers overseas, they're probably just going to start killing the volunteers because they're getting so mad.
Yeah.
I can't imagine anybody seeing an American overseas who's out in the boonies, maybe in the cities.
Yeah.
Yeah. What do you think about that?
Well, I think the reason we don't, what you say is fine. You know, and in a utopian world, if everybody were as smart as you or everybody else in this room.
Nancy.
Yeah.
Everybody as smart as Nancy.
Yeah, if everybody were like that, it would happen. But we got a really dumb country, I think. I mean, you go to school. It's been dumbed down. And I think the best way you get an education is not so much sitting in a classroom and learning it and having a syllabus as doing it. And when you do it and then you augment that with reading or discussion or talks, then your public policy IQ goes up. We got such a... all the good things that should be so easily done are hard to do because we've been dumbed down. You know, my uncle and generation, you know, they did the war together. They saw the world. They came back and they said, oh, man, the world is ugly. I want to make sure that things are good back here. They were, you know, fixing things. They had resources. They had a whole frontier. They weren't crowded. But now we're not doing that in the same numbers. What we send out into the world are killing machines. We're good at it.
I know.
Today's UT editorializes, and it says, California has as much oil as Saudi Arabia. Are we going to listen to the experts, or are we going to listen to these fools who want us to stop drilling? That's today's UT. So you talk about dumbing us down, getting us to think weird ideas about the environment, that it's okay to drill, baby, drill. This is our hometown newspaper, and that bastard is trying to buy the Chicago Tribune. You know what that means?
The
LA Times.
Yeah.
So he would have everything south of Bakersfield to the border, except the Orange County paper, and they're a little bit to the right of Manchester. So, God help us.
Lawrence?
Derek, you know, in American makeup, we were frontiersmen. We killed all the buffalo. We've done all that. We go out and play football. I played football. It's fun to get in there and beat the hell out of the other team. And it's all over. It's throughout our society. People want to win and they want to get ahead. And the Republic would never let you stop doing what we're doing now. I mean, all the congressmen and everything get paid by those defense contractors. So we can't just stop. But Obama is pulling us out of those wars, and he's starting to do good things, and he won't let them cut our Social Security and stuff. So it's got to be a long, gradual practice. But, you know, even after the Second World War, we were admired throughout the world because we rebuilt the world against that aggressor, Germany. But now China is building up its military. So what we got to do is beat China at helping them out, understanding democracy and freedom and stuff, before they get a big military in which someone's going to have to fight against.
Yes.
Well, back to the plan, the World Service Corps, you're talking it would take federal legislation?
Yes.
And then the volunteers make a stipend? How is it?
Yeah, they get paid like a Peace Corps volunteer gets paid, which would be less than what a volunteer soldier, private, lowest rank, would get paid. So it's not a big money maker, but if you live like on a Peace Corps salary, and you get, at the end, you get a 220, the Peace Corps used to be $250 or so for each month you serve times like 24 months, you get that as a cash bonus at the end. The same thing would apply. And you also, if you do this, if you do 2 years, you get 2 years of community college played plus 2 years of state college tuition, which a couple of years ago was around $15,000-$16,000 if you went to community and state college. And so on an average across the country. And or you could take it as a, if you're a rich kid, you could take it as a tax write-off, a tax credit. Or if you're not interested in schooling, you use it for vocational school, any kind of schooling, but you could take it as a home down payment. So we tried to put some incentives in there to attract a base. And if you did it, and you said, I want to do this for 2 years, you don't need any of that stuff, but you have a nephew or niece, you could assign it to your nephew or niece and say, this is for so-and-so, I'm doing the 2 years. So that then gets some of the baby boomers and stuff out of the workforce, which opens it up for others. And what we stress in the legislation is that you do this, you're probably going to get assistance if you want to go to school. Because I think part of the reason I got into Claremont was because, you know, they saw this guy banging away in an application from Bombay in the slums, and they gave you something. You know, they... And that's good to have in the classroom, because when I went back in the classroom, it's the same thing I was suggesting. You know, I read a lot in college. I like reading. I like learning. But hell, I went back in the classroom. I listened to all these guys working for their PhDs, and they'd say stuff, and I'd say, well, that's not right. You know, that's not the way it is in the real world. They had never been out doing service in some country. And that brings something back to the classroom that's much more real. And sometimes the professor, you know, doesn't know that much. So, yeah.
So another thing is that the Peace Corps, you know, was a very inspiring idea, but it had a very, it had a champion, you know, and I'm just wondering, have we thought about, you know, who that person might be?
Yeah, John Kennedy. This is kind of like copying off of John Kennedy, who copied off of Humphrey, who copied off of the congressman before him with the Peace Corps idea. But Kennedy, you know, right when the Peace Corps started, said, I want this to grow to 100,000 like that.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think the Peace Corps has grown to, the highest it's ever been in 1 year? 16,000. When I was in, it's around 8,500. That's volunteers who have served and trained. So you haven't had a hell of a lot, about 200,000 over that whole period of time. Kennedy wanted 20 or 30 million by now. If you had 20 or 30 million who had served by now, would your public policy IQ be above an imbecile's by a hair? No. So that's,
but the question is,
Obama, I wrote to all the presidential candidates. Bill Clinton responded positively, which I kind of say, well, maybe that was when Hillary was running too. And then Obama was the only other one, and his, it's on the website, says something like, it's these kind of things that inspire me on the campaign trail. And Obama talks about volunteerism a lot. Mm-hmm. Hagel, your new Secretary of Defense, I just finished his book, I can see why the Republicans don't like him very much. When I went back to D.C., we met with 22 offices, and the best offices to meet with were ex-soldiers. Sestak, Webb, Hagel, and the Democrats would say, have you talked with Chuck Hagel? And I say, well, yeah, tomorrow I'm talking with him. So I go to talk with him the next day, not him personally, because they told me to go back during a break, either right when the break is ending, because then the staff's coming back, and he says, if you come when they're in session, you're going to be in line behind all the lobbyists with the big, and they were right, you know. So I got there when the staff's just coming back, getting ready for the boss coming back, and he's going to be back full-time in 3 days. And Hagel's, Marie Stuckey was her name. She says, Dwayne, meet me. We're going to go have lunch. So she took me to lunch, and she's got this folder like this. I got my folder, and I'm always wondering, well, what am I going to say? I got to put out the important stuff. And I start my spiel. She says, stop. You don't have to tell me anything. I read all this stuff. She says, I got all your stuff in here. I've been printing it out. She said, what I'm going to do is Chuck came back today because he wants to take his family up into the mountains for 3 days before the recess ends. And she said, and he said, put together some reading stuff for me. She says, your stuff's going on top. And when you read his book, he talks a lot about, he doesn't mention the American World Service Corps per se, but he says service is a big part of his background, where they live, service. You served, you helped your community, you raised your barn, the same kind of stuff that this thing emulates. And so that's, if I don't know if that kind of got to your question. There are one more thing or so I wanted to mention about how you fund this. You know, this is the age of Buffett and Gates, if you want to look at guys who aren't afraid to say, I'm rich, but I want to do something good with it. And they're trying to embarrass the others into saying, hey, make sure you don't give it to your spoiled grandkids. And so they set the marker there, and then you got Ralph Nader saying, only the rich can save us. Took Ralph a long time to get to that spot. Okay, and so that's going on. Well, what I put into the bill was, you know, why don't you just go to these fat cats, celebrity fat cats, jock fat cats, the Forbes 400, and the Forbes used to run this thing about how much did the Forbes 400 richest Americans give to nonprofits, the charitable donations.
Yeah. That's, I remember that.
Yeah. And, you know, the Texan guy, Pickens, who used to come out to Marin because he wanted to do stuff out there with, you know, one of my guys I work with sometimes, big Pickens fans, and I said, yeah, well, Pickens gave a bunch of charitable stuff to build the UT Texas Stadium or University of Texas A&M. That's not exactly what I consider nonprofit donations. But if you list the 400, it averages out. You'll see a whole bunch who have zeros, zero, zero, zero. Gates and Buffett were, even at that time, 30 and 35%, you know, and they're going to give more. Adele was at 4 or 5 or 6%. You know, they're given very little. So I said, what you do if you get the World Service Corps legislation introduced is you have a website, Excel spreadsheet, list the Forbes 400, list what they're worth, list that column that said, what are your charitable donations, real charitable donations, to do good organizations such as the ones that are in the bill, and tell us what you donated every year. The same with the jocks, the same with the Hollywood celebrities. And say, there's nothing, we're not forcing you to do this, but everybody can go to the website and say, oh, Clint Eastwood gave what? Or, you know, whoever you want to look at. And there's some sort of public relations impetus there that I think would help. And it gets it down to the nine. Quit talking about, oh, rich people keeping the thing going. Okay, show us how they're keeping the thing going. And show us how they're saving your kid from going into the military. Romney's kids, you know, they're too important to go. So show us how you're funding these kids to go do the dirty work in the slums of Harlem that AmeriCorps workers do. So.
I have a question. Do you see a place for, like, the returning military people that are, you know, if we end two wars?
Well, yes.
There's going to be unemployment.
Yeah.
Could they be?
Let me tell you a quick story, I hope. I work with Nadia McCafferty very much, a Gold Star mom, who's friends with, if you know, Pat Tillman's mother and all. So I'm at her house one day when she has Dan Rather come out to interview her and these, movie companies. So I'm out there one day, and I get there a little late, and there's this guy who's in army fatigues, about 20-ish, you know, and the three cameras are on him, and he's talking, and he's telling his story, and I kind of listening to his story, and then I get to know him a little bit. The guy did 4 years in the military, 2.5 or 3 years, in Iraq, and he's talking about they're in a firefight. He's on the ground and they're in a firefight, and he's telling the cameraman, "Yeah, we got this firefight going. You know, you can't." And they're long firefights; you can't see who you're shooting. And he said, "And behind us is this Iraqi plowing his field with his mule, just plowing his field with his mule." And he says, "You know," and I'm laying there and I'm looking. And he said, "This is really good dirt, man." And I'm saying, "John, something's wrong with this kid, you know." And so I get to know him a little bit after this, and it turns out that he gets out of the military and he joined the Peace Corps. And they sent him to Africa, Nigeria, I forget which. And he had a little bit of farming experience, not much. And he says he walks into this village with, you know, all these big black farmers. He walks in and he's supposed to help them with their farming. He says, "I know shit about millet," you know. And he says, "You know, they're teaching me everything." Gets back to you learn more oftentimes. He says, "But I'm working there," and he says, "I'm starting to get it." He says, "I love it. This is right after, it's getting all that crap of Iraq out of his head." And he says, "I'm feeling great." He says, "Then I get a notice from the government. It says, report back for duty." And he says, "Wait a minute, I fulfilled my 4 years. I'm done." And they said, no, read the fine print. You're done until and unless the president, you know, if the president calls you back, he calls you back. And George Bush didn't want to draft anybody, so he called all these guys back. And he goes, "Oh, I don't want to go." And Michael O'Gorman works very closely with Nadia. He's a farmer who during the Vietnam era said, "I ain't going." And he went to Canada and Mexico, and he'd been a farmer ever since. And he has a real sympathetic spot for soldiers. So he had told them, any that you want to help, he'll help in any way he can. If they want to learn farming, he'll do that. And he went to Michael O'Gorman, and Michael O'Gorman said, "You know, I'm sorry, I will help you any way you want, but your case doesn't look winnable. And if you fight it and we don't win, I mean, you're going to go in the brig for a number of years." And the kid said, "I want to fight it." And he fought it, and he won. He didn't go to the brig. He's a farmer out of Berkeley now. And he's got a girlfriend. They're doing a, you know, small family farm. So that kind of answers your question. I mean, it's what the soldiers need. I had a guy, a Marine, come that just stayed at my house, or, you know, wants to do Zen yoga work. But he thinks this would be great for him.
When the draft was in, was the Peace Corps an alternative?
Yeah, it was an alternative when the draft was there.
Okay, so the chances are you might pick up more volunteers at that time.
Yeah, if you had a draft coming back, you'd get a lot more doing this, yeah. But they still, as soon as it, and like they drafted me 5 times, they really wanted me to be like Jim. But
so what I'm saying is, didn't you get more volunteers at that time?
Yeah, that's, some people say they were dodging the draft joining the Peace Corps.
That's a bad idea.
No, it was a pretty smart idea.
Yeah.
Oh, excuse me. Oh, wait a minute. Ladies first, Jim.
It's actually a reinforcement to what you said, that they gain more than they give. I'm a career development, I'm retired, career development counselor, and I would say 1/3 of my successful clients served in the Peace Corps. And all they talked about was,
is that right?
And how it changes them as human beings, what they learned in practical ways, so it influenced me indirectly too.
That's cool. That's cool. One third of your career people, huh? That's cool. Go ahead.
Quick follow up to your question. When I came back, I went immediately to graduate school, and I applied when I was in Vietnam. I was the most educated enlisted guy. Just as kind of aside, I had two master's degrees plus my bachelor's degree, and I was a gunnery sergeant. But that's another story. Anyway, I come back, and for the next 10 years, this happened to me. I'm on campus, I got a long hair beard, I'm chasing women. That's what saved me, is chasing girls. I swear, I really mean that. And immersing myself in a course of study that just consumed me when I wasn't chasing girls. So I had no time. So I'm walking across campus, going to a class, I hear footsteps. Guy said, "Mr. Evans, may I have a word with you?" Dark suit, always was the same. For the next 10 years, this scenario continued to happen. So your question, what happens to these guys coming back? If you're in special forces, special operations, you know something, they want you. Who? Your guess. This guy says, "May I have a word with you?" So, father-in-law, he wanted to hire me to go south of the U.S. border. He wouldn't tell me where. What would my mission be? He said, "You'd be working alone or maybe with one other person. Your choice. You pick the person if it's with one other person. Short missions, we would absolve you of all your debt." And the payment then, this was in 1969-68, the payment then was $50,000 for each mission. Today's money, add that up. This is what they do. This is how Blackwater gets their people. Mm-hmm. They go after SEALs, Marine Recon, which is where I was, Green Berets. They love these guys. And I said, "Why do you want me? You know what I've done." He says, "Oh yeah, we tracked you." They knew exactly what I'd written in papers and class. I said, "You know I hate this war." "Yes, but what we like is your training and you keep your mouth shut."
I benefited from the government again.
Yeah,
I
would have been paid assassin. So
Michelle had one last question here. I hope you that sunk in because, go ahead.
Yeah. Rushed over some of the details of this, and so I'm trying to understand the legislation. So in my mind, it seems like you're proposing that AWFC is going to be some sort of an umbrella over many of the nonprofit service and volunteerism or government.
Yeah, it would be, and I'm sorry, you're right, and I was trying to rush. The American World Service Corps office would be a small office that would be mostly concerned about making sure that when I did my service, I'd get paid every month, I'd get the
so
tuition.
So it would be an administrative sort
right.
of idea that you would collect names and then allow those people to go into those organizations, so absolve those organizations from the administration.
Yeah, from mostly the administration that says, "Here's your reward for doing the service." Mostly the administration of putting the person to work. Like if you join and said, "I want to do Peace Corps," Peace Corps already got their administrative staff. They're the ones that are doing most of the work. They're just tracking you at the American World Service Corps to say, "Okay, he's done his 2 years. Did we give him all of the stuff he's supposed to get?" And they may be the ones who take it in and said, "Well, this person wants to work for GLIDE. All right, send it to GLIDE." And GLIDE Memorial Church will decide. They got their administration, put them to work. So, yeah, it's not to be a big new organization. So it's.
So what's the point of it?
The point is to get 1 million Americans a year serving, and we don't have a way to do it.
So how do you do it?
By giving them some incentives, financial and otherwise, to come out and go do service in one of these existing organizations.
Something more than they would now get.
Something more than they would now get.
With the Peace Corps.
Yeah.
Okay, well, how would, say somebody down in Southeast San Diego, this is an organization, how would you funnel them to that group?
Well, say the mayor wants to, the schools down there aren't doing very well. If each of those, if say 50 teachers in a high school down there had two teacher's aides, would their students do better?
Yeah.
All right, so the high school might say, "I'd like 100 teacher's aides through the American World Service Corps umbrella. We'll put them to work. You just send them to us." All right, so 100 of them say, I can, you know, it's not going to be a lot of money, but I might want to be a teacher, and here I could do a year or two of service.
So would they go to you and say, what are my choices? Do you have a list of them, and then I can choose from that?
Yeah, there'll be a list that you can choose from. The American World Service Corps says you list all the organizations that are there. If you want to add your organization to it, you have to apply to the small committee, and they just check to make sure that you're not proselytizing, you're really doing work. And it would be organizations.
Okay, so what if, say, all right, those teachers down there, they don't have the money now to pay like Peace Corps does.
Yeah, well, they're going to get...
Who pays their
American money? World Service Corps pays those 50 volunteers who go to that high school in Southeast San Diego.
Okay, so you're going to pay them money, but you're not going to be paying the Peace Corps money.
No. Well, no. You know, they might decide that it's easier to funnel it through the... They're not going to be doing Peace Corps. They're going to be teacher's aides.
No, what I'm saying is right now you're saying that if they go in the Peace Corps pays for it, you just take care of the extra bennies.
Yeah.
Okay, Peace Corps got money. So these teachers down in Southeast San Diego don't have money. So they're not on an equal with the Peace Corps. So where do they get the money to pay their...
Well, that would come from the American World Service Corps budget.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so
they would pay them.
You're going to have more than just administration then. You're going to be setting up for others that don't have funds like the Peace Corps.
You would be the employer.
Yeah.
They would send you the time cards from those teachers. And you would send them a check for that?
Yeah, if it were an organization that didn't have something already set up. Yeah, like the Peace Corps would take... With the Peace Corps...
Well, how would you get your money down to the Peace Corps to pay those people that are working down there?
Well, the Peace Corps already... In the Peace Corps' case, you already have... You're getting paid. The extra, if you join the Peace Corps, might be the 4 years of college. The 2 years of community plus the two years of state. Over.
Those extra teachers you're going to send to the Peace Corps.
No, you're going to send them to the Peace Corps.
So for the community organization,
they're going to be separate.
So for the community organization, say these teachers, then you would provide a stipend for these extra teachers' aides?
The teachers' aides would be a new kind of organization. It would probably go through the high school unified school district. And if the high school said it's easier for you to send us the check to cover the teachers' aides.
So you basically work it out on an organization by organization.
Yeah, if they say it's more effective to send it to a unified school district and you pay them, that's one way. Or send it directly to the teachers' aide, that's another way.
Okay, but you're going to have funds for that.
Yes.
You don't have for the Peace Corps.
Oh, and the bill lists 7 funding mechanisms that are taxes. I list 7 traditional taxing mechanisms. The one I told you about, the richest 400, the spreadsheet, that's what I call the non-traditional tax funding mechanisms. If out of the Forbes 400, if they gave 1.7% of their annual wealth in a donation to fund the American World Service Corps, you'd need no taxes. But the 7 traditional taxing funding mechanisms, you know, like the Robin Hood tax is one of those things, and it's all in there. Those are things to be discussed, and probably some of them would be lobbied in or lobbied out. But 1.7%, that's the 2% solution. If just the Forbes, not the jocks, not the athletes, if they gave less than 2% annually of their wealth, they would fund the whole thing. And this is an expensive program because it's like $600 billion over 27 years.
Okay, so what if you don't have enough money to give those teachers? I mean, do you prioritize these organizations? What if you don't have the money?
No, I'm saying if you pass the bill, you've got to pass the law that says do this, and you got to put that stuff out there.
Yeah, but how do you know? How can you anticipate with the law how many people are going to want money?
Well, because I multiplied how much each of these would cost by 21 million volunteers, and
that doesn't make sense. I mean,
well, it does make sense.
Well,
it's the cost.
Not from what you're saying. How do you know if there's going to be 20 organizations down there that want, or 20 schools that want 3 people or not?
She's some sort of demand.
And so how are you going to know what the need is going to be? What if it's going to cost, not let's say, $2 billion, or if it's going to cost $6 billion? So how much are you going to be funding?
Would it be like a scholarship organization where they say, okay, we have this much money this year, for 25 scholarships or for 25 organizations. You know what I'm saying?
Well, if you, you need to go.
How do you know how much you're going to need?
Right.
You need to go to the website. I mean,
okay.
I can go in a bit more detail,
sure.
But if you have 150,000 signing up this year, you multiply the cost of that 150,000 as though they were all going to do it. And you multiply that and you say, that's how much money we need. Then you have seven tax-generating revenue streams that are traditional, plus four or five that are non-traditional, and you say, we're going to get the money from these. We're getting them all from the traditional, but if we get more or if we get some from the non-traditional, then we're going to return that. The Peace Corps used to return tax money to the federal government, unlike any organization up until that time. So if you raise more money from the non-traditional by saying the rich, you ought to give more, then you say to the federal government, we didn't need $10 million or $100 million. You keep it because we raised it by popularizing this program. So, but you know, what you're asking is a bunch of detail work, and there's a bunch of detail work at the website. Go worldservicecorps.us, go to financing tab and start looking at some of that stuff. And I've had, you know, you can kind of start getting a better idea of what that's about.
But I think you answered it when you said, assume the max. Assume we get all of these people, this is what it's going to cost.
Yeah.
And then we talk about the revenue, the funding.
Now last, I'm going to get down, I know Derek's, you know, the how thing, I wish you people would help in some way. If you think this is of interest, it is very helpful for you to write a letter, and it's probably even more helpful if it's a hard copy letter to congressmen, to Mayor Filner. And if your organization as a club would say something positive, like I'm hoping the Pacific Beach Club will say something positive, because all those little things help, and you don't know when you give it to a congressperson or a senator. I mean, I don't know what triggered Feinstein to call all the time. I know Boxer's introduced legislation for me before that was triggered maybe by stuff in the newspaper and op-eds and things like that. So, you know, if you think it was an interesting talk, I wish you'd do more than say, oh, I had an interesting talk. I wish you'd really, you know, do something, and Jim will have some ideas. So thank you for your time. So,
thank you, Dwayne.
Thank you.
Okay, next on the agenda is old business, the Executive Committee report. The Executive Committee met, and we talked about a whole bunch of stuff, and I think that's about